What's going on in Washington?
Free narcotics for drug addicts.
The farm problem is with us again, or still.
A problem in scientific censorship?
Adlai better get a hump on. NBC News presents Keys to the Capitol, an informal discussion of events and policies in Washington by four top NBC reporters. Listen now as these men take you behind the scenes in the Capitol with their reports and opinions on outstanding current issues. Tonight you will hear Bill Sprague, David Brinkley, Robert McCormick, and Richard Harkness. Here is Keys to the Capitol. And first, Bill Sprague.
Well, Senator Price Daniel opened an inquiry in New York this week on the narcotics problem, the highlight being the proposal by several authorities on the subject that the way to lick the drug peddling racket and cut down the number of addicts and the amount of crime committed by addicts is to make narcotics available at low cost. Judge Jonah Goldstein of New York General Sessions, for instance, he says that if drugs could be obtained legally and cheaply, the narcotics racketeers would be put out of business just as the bootleggers were when Prohibition was repealed. And he made this other point. Drug addicts do not commit crimes when they're under the influence, but in order to raise the money for another dose. Now, Judge Goldstein has had intimate contact with the narcotics problem in his position, and he's supported by evidence from leaders of the medical profession, namely the New York Academy of Medicine, who agree that dope addiction is more a medical problem than a criminal problem. It's certainly true that the fight against the narcotics traffic has been a losing one, and it might appear that it's time new methods were explored. I think it must be true that the narcotics racketeers are responsible for making addicts of people who otherwise would not take up the habit. After all, it's their business to create as many customers as possible. So what's your opinion of this scheme of undercutting the peddler's price, Dick?
Well, I don't know. Why don't we make whiskey cheap and just make all vice cheap, and that theoretically would cure everything. Oh, I think it's an outrageous idea, frankly.
Why not do the same thing with gambling? The trouble with gambling, one of the troubles with gambling, is that it's in the hands of racketeers. How about having the government take that over and operate a numbers racket?
I think you'll agree, though, won't you, that we're never going to wipe out the drug racket so long as there are human beings alive. The only way we can possibly do it is get at the sources, and, of course, the production of drugs is perfectly legal in the countries that produce the most of it. As a matter of fact, it's economically very, very important to the countries involved. So how else are we going to do it? What else would you suggest? Just let this mess get messier and messier, or what?
Well, that's, I think, perhaps the strongest point in favor of Judge Goldstein's argument is the fact that methods to now have proved relatively ineffective. Now, Dick, when you say make whiskey cheap, perhaps that was coming quick off the cuff. Actually, whiskey or alcoholic liquor is cheap. If you want to take the Sneaky Pete as an example, which a man can get a pretty good jag on for around 50 cents.
You know everything, don't you, Bill?
Well, I know about Sneaky Pete.
Perhaps that proves the point that here's a very cheap intoxicant called, what did you say it was?
Sneaky Pete is the term used for it.
Very cheap.
It's a kind
and
of paint remover.
That's available. That's available to people who are down and out and broke at this very cheap price, but it doesn't seem to have cured the drinking problem. Actually, these investigations always bring out the horror and sordid side of a situation like the narcotic situation, and it should be brought to light. But I noticed that our federal narcotics enforcement officer, Anslinger, had some rather interesting figures. He pointed out that when the Harrison Act, which prohibits the sale of drugs, was passed back in 1914, that one in every 400 persons was an addict. Now, today, with that law in force, the figure is one in 3,000.
Well, the law is in force, but the enforcement has been made so terribly difficult that with limited capacities and facilities, it seems to be impossible for either the federal or the local authorities to keep the thing in check.
Well, wouldn't your answer be in part, then, perhaps, to increase the budget for narcotics control, to increase your institutions where people are committed for cures, to attack it from that line rather than make it cheap, free, and easy for everybody?
Well, of course, the proposal that's been made is not the idea of having narcotics available at any drug counter for anyone to go in and pick them up. The proposal is for clinics to be established under properly supervised conditions, to which a drug addict may go and at a reasonable price get relief from this craving that he has, rather than his being forced to go to a peddler who will charge him 20 or 50 times what the stuff is worth and thereby force him into a life of crime in order to maintain his habit. I think you talked about a drinking problem, and certainly there is a drinking problem. On the other hand, is it your idea that prohibition would be the cure for it?
No, no, certainly not. I wouldn't go for that at all.
Well, what would be the result of these clinics? A drug addict would be able to get heroin or whatever he's taking quickly, easily, at a low price, could keep himself hopped up all the time with the assistance of the government. The benefit would be to take the profits out of the hands of the racketeers. Is that right?
Well, I think, again, you may be oversimplifying it. I don't know. None of this has never been put into practical application. But if you had a clinic to which an addict could go, obviously it would be the duty of the clinic to do whatever it could to restrain the habit and to try to bring the addict back to a normal life. Now, just what methods they would use in that, I'm not equipped
well,
to say.
Well, as I understood this thing, the idea was that if an addict got really desperate and there were a legal source of this drug, then in effect he has to put himself in the hands of people who, as Bill says, will try to help him rather than go out and murder three little storekeepers to get enough money to buy next week's slugs. I mean, it isn't quite as... It's been oversimplified terribly, it seems to me, in some of the papers because they've said... They've talked about it as legalizing the sale of drugs. It's not precisely that at all. And of course, I think probably the same system might have worked during Prohibition with alcohol, except too many people drink, and it just would be too monstrous a problem to tackle.
I think alcohol and narcotics have got to be divided, because although people do get certainly in the alcoholic habit and feel a very strong compulsion to satisfy their craving... It doesn't appear to have anywhere near the force that the narcotics addict desire has. Apparently, he'll do anything to get another shot of dope, whereas an alcoholic probably just gets sick.
Doesn't this deal more with the problem that's been pointed out in the hearings in New York with heroin and morphine rather than what seems to be contributing so much to juvenile delinquency, and that is marijuana?
Well, that's a very strong point against this plan. The fact that marijuana is available cheap already. And, of course, marijuana can be a little more easily controlled, perhaps, because it is native grown.
Marijuana is not habit forming, isn't it? You apparently have done a lot of research on it.
Well, it's, maybe, you're putting me in a very embarrassing position.
Well, I thought possibly you might have read somewhere.
Well, I'll see you after the program. All maybe right. I can fix you up.
Maybe this would be a good time to change the subject.
Yeah.
So saying, I will. The farm problem. About 2 weeks ago, when the Republicans had a political meeting here in Washington and they unveiled in big banners hanging on the walls, one of the slogans they are expecting to use in next year's campaign, the slogan goes, "Everything is booming but the guns," which is a pretty good slogan, and Leonard Hall, the Republican chairman, seemed to be proud of it, but it appears now it might need a little revision. It might be changed to read, "Everything is booming but the guns," to say nothing of farm prices. And that actually is about the only serious political worry the Republicans have here in this country. Most of the economy is booming and money is circulating at an enormous rate. Most everybody has a job. But in the face of all this, farm income is going down, and at a time when the prices of some of the things the farmer buys, such as farm machinery, are going up. Well, there's some difference of opinion about why this is so. But there is agreement it's a threat that's a threat to the Republicans' chances in 1956 unless something is done about it. Agriculture Secretary Benson says he will have some suggestions to make when the new Congress comes in next year, but he doesn't say what they are. If he comes up with anything really new, it will be quite a surprise to everybody, because for years, teams of experts have worked over this thing and have tried almost every conceivable plan that might be of benefit to the farmer. And they have, some have been successful and some have not, but they have proved to be very expensive. Today, for example, the Agriculture Department says that in the last fiscal year,
its losses on the farm price support program came to $799 million, almost double the losses it had the year before. It also says that we now have more than $7 billion tied up in farm surpluses and are still piling in. In spite of all this government money going out, farm income has still fallen below the level of the rest of the economy. Benson made a speech today blaming it on the Democrats, and he says when they left, that's standard procedure for both parties, of course. He says when the Democrats left office, they left a group of time bombs lying around with delayed fuses, which are just now exploding. Well, there isn't enough time in the day, much less this program, to go into all of the ramifications of which party has done what to or for the farmer. But one thing is certain, when a farm issue comes up in the Congress, both parties are eager to vote some kind of benefits. Well, this particular problem, the one existing today, is new, and there's been a continuous farm problem of one kind or another for as long as I can remember. And it seems to me there is very small chance for any complete solution to it. We have already reached the point where the farmer is to a great extent a ward of the government, and an expensive one. First, obviously, because we have to eat and we can't allow farmers to go broke and the lands to fall into ruin. And second, because members of both parties want his vote, and so somebody is always demanding that something be done for the farmer. As I say, I see no long-range solution from the Republicans or Democrats or anyone else. Do you? Does anyone here?
No. I think we're sort of in a middle period here. Mr. Benson is right to a certain extent that this $7 billion worth of farm surpluses, that almost $800 million worth of loss last year, was piled up under the what we might call the Democratic 90% of parity plan, although it was supported by a lot of Republicans. And the Republican sliding scale or flexible scale of parity price supports has not really become effective as yet. So I'm not so sure, but what Mr. Benson has a good point of view from the standpoint of logic. However, I'm sure the Republicans also are thinking back to 1948 when everybody, including Tom Dewey, thought Tom Dewey was going to beat Harry Truman. But then the farmers, Iowa, went Democratic that year, if you'll recall. So that the Republicans do have a very real political, not only a headache, but a serious situation on their hands. How they're going to deal with it, I don't know, and I dare say that Mr. Benson is wondering, too.
Well, Dick, the concrete suggestion has been made, Mr. Benson has mentioned it himself, that the government might do one of two things. Either lease land outright from the farmers to keep it out of production, and alternately to pay the farmers direct subsidies for keeping their land out of production. That second plan, Mr. Benson seemed to favor on the basis that it would mean far less in the way of administrative overhead. Now, that, of course, is a stopgap proposition, but what it might serve to do in the long run would be to take the load off the government of the tremendous storage costs that they're piling up. Those storage costs, the necessity for hiring all this equipment and everything from blimp hangers to oil storage tanks to put wheat and potatoes and things like that in, is a big part of that loss.
About $1 million a day it costs.
Yes, and if the stuff wasn't produced in the first place, it would cut down the loss, pending the time when, as Mr. Benson puts it, the agriculture adjusts itself to our present needs.
Well, I'll bet Henry Wallace is sitting on that farm in upstate New York just grinning, because that's exactly, in effect, what Henry Wallace did back in the depths of the Depression.
At this time.
But what bothers me, I'm not an agricultural expert, as is Mr. Brinkley.
We all are, of course.
Yes, I know. I can tell from the stentorian tones you use, but I can't.
What can you tell from my talk? I certainly don't claim to know anything about it. Go ahead.
What I can't figure out is, with so many hungry people all over the world, why some more vigorous effort isn't made to distribute this surplus food to people that need it, rather than just let it sit there and rot. Now, I know each country has an individual problem. I know that in certain areas, corn, grain will not be eaten, in the rice areas particularly. I also know that even in Germany, there are very severe restrictive measures on the import of agricultural products, restrictions which we should have obliged the Germans to remove when we were occupying them, but with our usual policy of doing anything not to displease the Germans so long as they'd rearm, we didn't. So we can't export to Germany, but there must be great areas where we could get rid of some of this, and there'd be a lot of people that are hungry now who might have little fat, round tummies.
I agree. I think the economy of scarcity is just wrong.
I think it's just dead wrong, but nobody seems to give in none of these plans, have I heard. Of course, I haven't been home very long, but I've not heard yet a single solid study of the prospects of being able to dump this surplus on other countries. Even if we dumped it at a considerable loss, we'd still save money if it costs $1 million a day just to keep it in a bureau drawer.
Benson had a news conference the other day, and that question came up, and he'd just come back, he said, from a trip to 8 or 10 European countries, and he said everywhere he went, he found the governments of these countries frightened to death, almost, for fear that the United States would dump these surpluses on the world markets and depress their prices. Their own farmers would be unable to get anything for their crops because we would flood the markets with ours.
Well, partly that's because the domestic consumption in many of these countries is lower than it should be because prices are too high and they export to get the dollar exchange.
Well, if you're going to subsidize, why not give the farmer the difference between a dumping price and the world price, say, for wheat? And then put it on. It seemed to me that out of that whole fair deal series of experimentation, that the one solid plan for getting rid of surpluses was originated, Bob, by our friend Milo Perkins, the surplus food stamp plan.
Yes.
Now, it got rid of some of the surplus, and the food was consumed by our own school kids who needed it. Now, that, and relief families. Yeah. That made a lot of sense.
Well, it still does to me.
It's senseless to have that food lying there while people are hungry.
And spoiling, of course it is.
Well, I want to bring up another good controversial subject. I don't know whether you people have paid much attention to the story or not. I think it's been dreadfully underplayed. But it involves Dr. Herman Muller, the Indiana University professor who, as you know, won the Nobel Prize and whose scientific specialty happens to be a hobby of mine. It's genetics, the study of the inheritance of human characteristics. Now, he's undoubtedly one of the two or three top men in the world in his field. No one could argue about it. And he happens to think that the world may be in great danger from the radiation effects of exploding H-bombs and even from the use of atomic power. And as the acknowledged expert on the subject, he'd prepared a paper for presentation at the Atoms for Peace Conference in Geneva, but he was not allowed to read that paper. After a lot of denials and buck-passing and weaseling around, the Atomic Energy Commission finally admitted that it was responsible for keeping Muller off the program on the grounds that he discussed the bombing of Hiroshima and that that was an act of war and not an act of peace, which seems quite obvious. Consequently, his paper, they said, wouldn't be suitable in an Atoms for Peace conference. Well, to me, that's just downright silly. The radiation from peacetime uses of nuclear energy will be just as great potentially as that we'll get from military uses. And if someone of Muller's stature thinks we may be cooking up a big mess of inherited trouble for ourselves, I think we're entitled to know about it. As a matter of fact, it's particularly interesting to me because the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission has taken a directly contrary view. He has said, in effect, that any such worries about inherited characteristics are nonsense. The chairman, Louis Strauss, is a very well-known man. Comes from a banking family, was an assistant to Admiral Denfeld during the war when Denfeld was chief of the Bureau of Naval Personnel, and Strauss himself now holds the rank of Rear Admiral in the Naval Reserve. But when it comes to an evaluation of what an H-bomb explosion will do to my grandchildren and great-grandchildren, I certainly would like to hear what Nobel Prize winner Muller has to say. I don't think the fact that his views differ from those held by Reserve Rear Admiral Strauss should have anything to do with whether Muller's views are given worldwide publicity, but maybe I'm wrong. Can I get an argument out of it?
I second the motion.
So do I. So do I.
Well, it's merely about the only thing I think that you can say and on the other side of the question, which I'm deliberately trying to take, is that this was an Atoms for Peace conference with an agenda fairly carefully laid out as to what they would cover and what they would not cover. I don't know whether the Atomic Energy Commission took the position that this paper should be entirely suppressed or whether it should not be aired at this particular meeting. Do you know that, Bob?
Well, Strauss was quoted as saying on a television program when he got back, I believe it was when he got back from Geneva, there was a good deal of discussion of radiation hazards. Some of the irresponsible statements that had been made on the subject were liquidated in the course of that conference, which would indicate they'd talked about it and that the Admiral had decided it was nonsense, so far as I can read anything into this.
Didn't Mueller get quite a runaround instead of just saying we don't think your paper's suitable for this conference? Wasn't he told that the United Nations wouldn't give him an invitation or something?
That's right. First, the Atomic Energy Commission said that the United Nations, that's what they told Mueller, as I understand it, that the United Nations didn't want him, and the United Nations promptly cracked back and said we had nothing to do with it. It's up to the country involved. And then the Atomic Energy Commission put out the statement that he talked about Hiroshima. Well, how are you going to talk about nuclear radiation if you don't discuss the few instances in which we know it to exist?
Absolutely.
The fact that it happened to come in a war, I don't think, has anything to do with it.
Well, that's about the only time we have ever had a chance to check its genetic effects, because it's the only time it's ever been used on people.
Well, certainly, only twice.
And there in Nagasaki?
Yes, and how else are you going to study it?
Well, only to make this, maybe it's a hair-splitting point, but the effects of radiation from the use of the atom for peace and the effects of radiation from the use of the atom in a bomb might be two entirely different subjects.
But didn't Dr. Mueller have some doubts about use of the atom for power?
Oh, yes, he does, very definitely. And my whole contention is that if a man of his capabilities has those doubts, I certainly think they ought to be thrashed out.
They certainly should be listened to, even if they're wrong.
Yeah, well, and then, of course, they go ahead and publish his paper in the official transcript of the conference after saying that the subject matter isn't appropriate.
Oh, well, I didn't realize that.
Well, yes, they've announced that it will be published, but, of course, he did not get an opportunity to have it discussed in a world forum. The only purpose of that conference was to dramatize the whole situation.
Did they decide to include it in the transcript only after this story broke?
Well, they announced that they were going to include it in the transcript after the furor, but when the decision was made, I don't know.
I think we're pretty much in agreement on that one. Move over to something where a subject where everybody is an self-styled expert, and that's politics. I think that everyone who's covering politics around Washington these days had been looking forward to the 56 nominating conventions as rather drab affairs. That is, all cut and dried. Eisenhower for the Republicans, Stevenson for the Democrats, and then we'd all come home. Now, I'll still take President Eisenhower as running again on the Republican ticket, but it seems that when it comes to the Democrats, that something's stirring. It even seems safe to say that if Stevenson really wants the nomination, he'll have to break his silence and do it shortly, declare himself to be a candidate, and then get out and work and line up delegates. Now, one development here is the increasing evidence that Governor Abel Harriman of New York is getting the presidential bug. Now, Harriman says that he's still for Stevenson, but Harriman's political mentor, Carmine DiSapio of Tammany Hall, has come up with a somewhat novel proposal. He's suggesting to Democratic Party leaders that they take what he calls a grassroots poll to see who was the real Democratic choice in 56, Stevenson, Harriman, or exactly who it may be. And DiSapio is speaking shortly at a Democratic dinner out on the West Coast. So there is evidence that he may be trying to do another Jim Farley. That is, as Farley covered the country shaking hands, building up a New York governor named Franklin D. Roosevelt back in 1931, that DiSapio may go out in behalf of Harriman. Now, none of the professional politicians here is counting out Senator Kefauver either. Now, Kefauver probably will go into the Democratic primaries as he did in 52. He's a handy man corralling delegates that way. In fact, as you'll recall, he went to Chicago in 52 with the most delegates, and then he was counted out by the machine, which went for Stevenson. Now, the uncertainty that Stevenson has the nomination in his best pocket is making itself clear in a very practical way. Now, suddenly there's been a blossoming of Democratic favorite sons. For instance, Governor Soapy Menon of, Williams it is, isn't it? Yeah, Menon Williams of Michigan, Lousy of Ohio, Clement of Tennessee, and Chandler of Kentucky. Of course, you can name two, Senators Russell of Georgia and Humphrey of Minnesota. Now, these men have no real idea of winning the Democratic nomination, although any politician dreams, of course, that he may be struck by lightning. But they will go to the 56th convention at Chicago controlling their state delegations, and that will put them in a position to make a deal with the major candidates. Plainly, if Stevenson had the nomination locked up, these favorite sons would be on his bandwagon already. Now, this is not to report at all that the party will turn down Stevenson, but as of today, he's no sure thing. Bob, you want to take a whirl on Governor Harriman?
Well, Dick, I don't know much about domestic politics anymore, but it always seemed to me, from what little information I could get, that Stevenson actually never had the physical control over the party, did he, that a regular machine politician would have. I mean, it never seemed to me that he controlled the machine politics in the various states the way other Democratic and Republican leaders have, the way Dewey controlled the Republican Party.
No, he didn't. He did have his own chairman, Steve Mitchell, of course, of Chicago, but Mitchell's out and Paul Butler is in. And while he had control of certain groups up in the North, he's never had any real control, and there's the rebellion still brewing down in the South. Bill, you're recently from New York. How about Harriman?
Well, I don't know just how to answer that, Dick. Harriman, as a governor, is, of course, completely in control of New York. That is, DeSapio is, and Harriman is his man. Now, I don't think my being from New York has a great deal of application to what we're trying to dope out here.
Let me put it more specifically. Harriman is, I think, the one man who has the out-and-out mantle of the late Roosevelt and then ex-President Truman. He ran on a New Deal platform in the state of New York. He's installed what I think amounts to a little New Deal up there. His budget officer, Paul Appleby, the old friend of ours, Bob, a New Dealer. Do you think that's popular in New York?
There wasn't that much cleavage in the election, as a matter of fact, when he beat Senator Ives. It wasn't a New Deal versus a highly conservative proposition. The thing that muddied up that election completely, and which may have thrown it to Harriman, was a raising of the communist issue, which backfired. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that the people of New York generally felt that they were going to get either a New Deal or the opposite as a result of the election.
Do you people think Harriman, I haven't seen him for years, of course, but do you think he's a strong enough character actually to win out in any such turbulent business as a Democratic convention? And if he does, can he hold the thing together?
Well, I would say he's about as strong a man as Adlai Stevenson from that standpoint, Bob.
Yeah.
Well, with DeSapio in back of him, if DeSapio is in back of him, he's certainly somebody to be reckoned with.
Yeah, like Stevenson had, and I don't know, again, Jacob Harvey.
I was going to say that the late Colonel Harvey was probably the strongest force in back of Mr. Stevenson during the convention.
Go ahead, David.
I'd spent a good deal of time in the South lately, not on politics, but on another story. Well, on the segregation thing, actually. And wherever you go, you talk politics, you know. And I think the opposition to Stevenson in the South is at least as strong now as it was in 52, and maybe even stronger. I think, actually, the school segregation thing might even have irritated it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is the issue on which has caused his unpopularity in so many places.
Thing,
of course,
Dave,
he is in no way connected with it, but
wouldn't it be greater reaction against the Republicans on that than against anybody in the Democratic Party?
Or let's turn that around. Down south, David, wouldn't there be as much, if not more, reaction against Harriman than Stevenson? Because actually in 52, Harriman was sort of the northern Dick Russell. He stood for civil rights and so forth, as Russell stood for states' rights.
It might very well be. What I'm saying is that the issue is more live now than it was in 52 because a lot of things...